Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. With me in studio today is Paul Krasinski, founder and CEO of Epicenter Experience. Paul, welcome to the show.
Andrew, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Glad to have you in. And I often ask folks right out of the gate, what got you interested in technology? What got you interested in what you're doing today?
I actually think it dates back to fourth grade when I said to my teacher, wouldn't it be awesome if you could have a relationship with everyone in the world? And even though she should have rolled her eyes, she said, you can make that happen. So for me, technology's always been a great facilitator of connection and collaboration among people. And it allows us to kind of solve issues that are facing the world. And obviously, we know today there's a lot of communication gaps. And even though there's no substitute for face-to-face interaction, I think we really wanted to see, how do consumers make decisions? I've always been fascinated by people. You know, sneakers, how do they come on? Internet superstars, how do they come up? How do people decide between one technology or another, or an electronics or another, or a puppy or another? That was always interesting to me. So I knew that with technology, you could get a broader understanding from a much larger population of people.
Did you have any other teachers throughout high school that were kind of formative in pushing you in that direction?
I did. Actually, my Spanish teacher from high school and I are still in contact, but it was interesting. It was the first experience I had to leave the country, went to Costa Rica for 3 weeks. And one, I realized I didn't speak the language as well as I thought I did. I might have done it well through the libros, but definitely not from a fluency perspective. So I quickly realized that communication was really important. And when you couldn't speak the language, it was actually how you conducted yourself was most important. So Senora Knight is still a great mentor and advisor to me and continues to be part of any of the initiatives that I do, always as a sounding board, not dissimilar to this place, this studio here.
Very good. Shout out to Senora.
Yes. Hello, Senora Knight.
So then after high school, you went to Brown.
I did. Yeah. I played basketball at Brown, was class of 1998. It was a great experience. It was one of those life-changing experiences where it was good enough for me to say to my younger brother, hey, you have to come to Brown if you get in here. But it was really interesting. It became kind of the first foray into a truly global community where everyone's experiences were different, technologies, cultures, everything really was different there. It was a unique way to draw your own path through. And playing basketball freshman year, coach had a very clear directive, which was, as you would imagine, with podcasts reaching so many people, freshmen were not allowed to speak to the media. And so he said, as a freshman, you are not allowed to speak. So as I walked out of the gym one day, past all the media, just waving, there was a gentleman at the end. And he said, are you Paul Krasinski? And I said, I am Paul Krasinski, but I have no contacts. I'm a student. I don't know what I can offer you. And he said, well, can you just come and speak to my class once? And he was a teacher at Hope High School, which was one of the least resourced high schools in the state of Rhode Island. And I said, sure, I'd be happy to come. And so I walked in that first day. And again, around human values of connection and collaboration and growth and really wanting to contribute, I think that mustered all my strength to stand in front of that classroom. And the first hand went up and it was, white boy, what do you know about what I'm going through? And it was the first time that I had really been challenged just overtly, one, by a younger person, but two, I thought it was a great opportunity to kind of learn about myself and be curious about him. And I said, I don't know everything about what you're going through, but I do know that I played basketball in a lot of neighborhoods. And while you might think South Providence is horrible, it's actually not as bad as you think. And so we left that first class. Thank God the bell rang and I stepped outside and Floyd Narcisse, who was the teacher in the classroom, said, that was amazing. You reached them. You gave them some inspiration and some hope that there is things beyond the walls of this school and beyond the geographic regions of Providence. And I said, no, that was terrifying. That was the worst thing ever. And he said, no, you got to come back. So it turns out I stayed with that classroom for 4 years. They were freshmen and I was a freshman. And they were coined the attitudinal and behavioral classroom, which I didn't really understand what that meant. But what I will tell you is we learned a tremendous amount about each other. I think it was the connection that we started to form over those 3 years together. And we literally went every Wednesday and Friday. But as it started to evolve, I realized that we could teach math through Shaq O'Neal's contract, or we could teach science by getting outside and walking the beaches that they hadn't seen a horseshoe crab ever in their lives. And these were just things that came second nature to me, and I was enjoying it. So I fast forward those 4 years, and as I'm graduating, I'm walking out the Van Wickle Gates, which is a famous gates at Brown on graduation day. And there's all my students, and they're all there lined up, and they're in their ties and blazers. And I said, guys, this is such a surprise. And one of the students raised their hand. I said, uh-oh, here I am all over again, going back to freshman year. What question could ever come out of their mouth? And it was, hey, so Paul, what's next? And I said, well, if you can believe it, I got an agent. I'm heading to Amsterdam to play professional basketball. And he said, no, for us. And it was at that moment that I sat and said, wow, I had been focused on self when in reality, giving to others was going to be my purpose in life. And it was through that connection and through that communication and driving hope and inspiration, I had looked back at that with that question and said, I had gone to the director of admissions with no hope of anything in exchange. I just said, hey, can these kids come on campus and be engaging the computer labs and the library and the classrooms? And I went to the director of athletics, again, with no sense of a reward or personal benefit. It was more trying to give these kids a look into what's possible and actually give them a blueprint for the future. So at that point, I really committed myself to trying to impact the lives of as many people as possible. So embarking on a business career in New York City doesn't seem like the philanthropic thing to do, but always in the back of my mind was, it wasn't about the money. It wasn't about the salary. It was more about finding solutions to problems. And so I went down that course, got my first technology job, looking at ideas for an incubator. And there was a Brown alumni who was running this fund. And at a very early age, I was the director of research and review, which meant I could look at all of the ideas and we made investment decisions. Ultimately, that led me to seeing technology as a very unique way to look at a problem, see the gap and see the market, and try to fill those gaps with technology rather than simply throwing either money or people at the problem. So that was kind of the start from Brown, which propelled me. But I think it was one of those clear moments where you sit there and you say, what changed you in your core fabric as a person? And why did you decide to pursue? Floyd Narcisse passed away about 10 years ago, but it's amazing to see that hopefully his legacy of giving and really investing in the youth of America and solving problems. I certainly credit him, like Senora Knight, with some of at least who I feel like I am and becoming thus far.
What was it like to play basketball in Europe?
It was really interesting. You know, I will say it was more of a finesse game. So here in the United States, it was definitely more physical and pushing. So I fouled out of my first 4 games and coach threatened to send me back onto U.S. soil if I couldn't get my game together. So all of a sudden, I learned how to play more finesse, which at 6'9", 245 pounds, it was harder to do that. I was always a land animal or a giraffe looking individual. But what was most interesting about it was the culture. So again, a different look at people where it was really my second time saying there's a sense of American exceptionalism out there. The coach had to coach in English. You know, our workouts, our teachers were all in English. And yet all the other team members spoke 6 languages. They came from all these different places. And so that was another interesting way of just changing my perspective of how I think and not in a very provincial kind of self-focus, but also not just a domestic United States focus. But what I will tell you is the best fun that we had was Tuesdays and Saturdays we had games. But between Tuesday and Saturday, basically coach just said, hey, get in the gym, do your runs, get your shots up. Obviously, that meant to the 2 other Americans and myself, you go to get Ryanair flight passes in a packet. So we would leave in a car service to Schiphol Airport every Tuesday night. And we'd walk up, and at the time it was pre-9/11, we'd rip off a ticket and say, we're going to Dublin. We're going to Paris. We're going to Belgium. So for me, it was a great opportunity because it's a big to-do coming from the United States overseas for a vacation. But when you're there, it's a shuttle flight away and it really makes it great. So then I started to realize, again, kind of tying back to this idea of connectivity, you realize why Europe is so tight and why they are actually cross borders and much more inclusive of people and ideas. And certainly we have some incredible innovation here, but it was just an interesting cultural phenomenon for me to just be exposed to. So it was great. I really had fun. I played for 2 years there and then said, unlike Tommy Boy, I better come back to the United States and get a job at some point.
Well, you did so. And I think your first job there was at Metro Networks.
Yeah, Metro Networks. So I actually saw digital coming up as, and at the time, Mark Cuban had done broadcast.com, and yet there was still no measurement of audiences for internet audio or podcasts. And so I met with the CEO at the time of Ando Media, Bob Messini, and he had highlighted that, hey, we have this idea of creating really the Nielsen or Arbitron ratings for internet audio. The interesting part about that story was it started as very little, and it was all IP-based connected. So you were looking at log files to determine who was connected, what device, and how long they were there. So it was kind of limited information compared to the panels and estimates of Nielsen and Arbitron, where they had 80,000 people, but a lot more information. The key there was when I left, we had 75% of the market, which is in its own right a great accomplishment, but it was more you had Pandora, RDO, Spotify, Clear Channel, Cumulus, CBS, Cox. And it was interesting to see the old line and new line broadcast models kind of clashing, right? So on one side, you had Clear Channel saying, hey, we're the largest radio network in the world, really. And we're not going to give Pandora any voice. And yet you had Pandora coming up just as organically as we know technology does. It democratizes how people listen and it doesn't matter. People are really the center. They're going to drive what they want. So it was interesting to see rating points between Pandora and Clear Channel start to become similar and they were commanding higher premiums on advertisers and brands. So Metro Networks was an interesting one. I actually was deployed here to Boston as leading the East Coast for sales and product. And what was really interesting about it is you realize quickly the power of relationships. So what a novel concept was network radio that essentially was not owning stations, but really delivering content to stations. So whether it was traffic or weather, or as part of Westwood One, it was sports and the entertainment properties. But it didn't matter how good your properties were if the underlying relationships with the buying community weren't there. So what I realized when I came here was we didn't have the use of technology. We hadn't thought about digital. And we started to introduce this concept of over the air, online, and in the moment. And what was interesting about that is it was kind of early on in the days of 2005 to 2007 where people were starting to look at these integrated moments, but it didn't matter how good your technology was, and it didn't matter that you were modern. If you couldn't build relationships and your product was or wasn't respected, you'd have trouble running down that path. So ultimately, Metro Networks was a great foundation for me to understand the radio industry, both from the product development side and the production side, but also from the sales and marketing side, which led me to be successful at Ando Media when I switched over to the more streaming internet audio.
Yeah, and then they've grown into Triton, which they're famous now for measuring podcast and streaming content. I see their reports that come out every month.
Yeah, the webcast metrics. So literally, we grew Ando Media from 2006 to 2008. And I think in 2008, we sold to Triton Media Networks, which was a subsidiary of Oak Tree Capital at the time. And they really had a vision for combining kind of ad serving and measurement for the industry to give one look at kind of a total audience measurement. And I thought it was interesting, but after the purchase, it seemed like the Triton guys were more into the ad serving piece. And I said, hey, the measurement piece is really where it's going to be at. And back to my fascination with people, understanding consumer behavior was really going to be important. So I approached the CEO and it was a very funny dialogue of Arbitron. And I said, look, if you're not looking at digital audiences as much as you are the 80,000 people. That's like calling 300 million people off of 80,000 versus saying, hey, we can look at 95 million people for 300. And they said, yeah, but it's overvalued. Why don't you just come run digital here? So I had the opportunity to work inside of Arbitron. So understand at its core, I had the very near census-based experience from a technology perspective where it was IP-based measurement. Then you're seeing the panel-based measurement where it's estimates, surveys, and projections. And you start to get a feel for the pros and cons and strengths and weaknesses of both. We sold that company, obviously, to Nielsen in 2014 or 2015. And it was a great opportunity for Nielsen to kind of really look at digital plus broadcast across people. And that was a really big deal for me, as the thesis that I always had was, how do we empower the people to actually take control over their destiny and start to realize and speak back as a consumer to brands versus brands just doing the, you know, as we're all used to with ad tech, it's either impressions or clicks. And I said, yeah, but it's neither. You got to talk to people. And we're seeing that kind of come about now where brands are really interested in how do we create that connection directly with the person? How do we have a conversation? And for your listening audience, what's really interesting to me was, and it'll lead to why I founded the company that I'm at now, but there's $14 trillion that is spent by consumers on consumer spending. So 70% of the GDP. And there's $3.7 trillion spent on technology to reach consumers every year. And yet 60% of marketers say they don't have the tools and the right abilities inside their organizations to connect with the consumer. So that created this massive gap. So back to fourth grade, back to Hope High School, back to Amsterdam playing basketball, I sat there and said, this is just fundamentally a problem. So any technologist, any product person really wants to solve that problem. So when I looked at the market, I said, okay, I was uniquely positioned from the kind of IP-based census, very server-based methodology to a much more recruited panel methodology. But I said, if you add one more third piece of it, you add customer relationship management, marketing automation that was coming up, but they were looking at past transaction history for a predictor to future behavior. And I said, no, what we should do is create a mobile technology that literally connects the brand and the consumer, just like we're sitting here, as if they were at a Starbucks having a really authentic conversation. That was the goal. And I said, if we could do that, then brands could innovate faster. Consumers would have a unified voice. It wouldn't be fractured. And you actually could either inform brands or organizations or causes, if you will, and really have a positive impact and change on people. And so really, that's where the model for me shifted. It was living it and living the dream. A bit of, hey, from fourth grade, when you say, hey, wouldn't it be great to have a connection with everyone? Radio with a QM audience of 95% of the US population every week, you sit there and say, okay, that's a lot of people. And then you sit there and say, yeah, but are we really talking to them? Or are we broadcasting? Or are we hearing them? Or are we even listening? And I think brands for a long time started to say, hey, we know what's best for the consumer. And I think what we're finding, whether it's elections or education or healthcare, that it really, really matters what the consumer happens. So we founded a company called Epicenter Experience, which was just founded on two core principles. One, people are everything. They're the epicenter of everything. And two, their experiences, every experience has an impact on their life, whether it's positive or negative. And hopefully you're on the positive side of that. But we wanted to empower people to really sound off and be heard across any industry and really any cause and drive positive impact, which has been really interesting. And we can talk more about that for sure.
My dad told me never to talk to strangers or to recruiters or to strange recruiters.
It's so exciting when the website gives zero information about the job I am applying for.
You take 1 3-month sabbatical and all of a sudden you're unhirable.
You're not allowed to say it, but you're looking for someone younger than me. Joke's on you. I'm 11 years old.
Finding your next consulting gig should not be this difficult. Quite frankly, you deserve better. Syrinx is the consulting company founded and run by software consultants. We get you. Find out why our employees are some of the happiest and best paid consultants in the industry at syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com. Find a better way today. Syrinx Consulting is a proud sponsor of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry.
How is Epicenter experience manifested? Like, is it an app? Do you deploy it to folks per brand? Is it private labeled? How does that work?
So essentially, Epicenter Experience is the company, and our technology is called the People Platform. And it is a cloud-based mobile technology that uses proximity-based services, so geolocation services, to identify an anonymous device that's in a location or showing a pattern behavior. At that point, we said, hey, the consumer will drive that experience. So a first-party opt-in was something that was really important. And we had learned through John Thompson, who was the chairman of Microsoft, who was an investor and an advisor in our company, and he was nice enough to introduce us to Phil Spencer, who runs gaming at Microsoft, and the CTO of Microsoft. They said, we did this global study on the data and value exchange. And what they found was that 99.6% of people wanted to share personal information. However, they had two caveats. One, people wanted to be asked to participate. And two, they needed a real financial cash value. So outside of many of the rewards or virtual currencies or otherwise. So we took that to heart, and they saw that we were trying to approach that problem in a way of saying, hey, we recognize that your information is valuable. We will reward you and actually give you that financial for participating. And what we saw was that instead of just being app focused, where you either have an SDK or your own app, that was becoming more like the Arbitron's market research of the world, where you were taking a small segment of a recruited population, but it really wasn't giving you the consumer index. So what our developers, and they had worked with me for, you know, 2 and 3 companies, that I said, there's got to be a better solution. So what we came up with, and our patent is pending, and I think it's going to be granted soon, on the ability to actually use the ad technology differently. What we said is, hey, once we identify and qualify someone in a location or with a pattern of behavior, reach out to that device, still anonymous, and see if that person wants to interact. So you visited a Best Buy, care to share your experience. One, the person has to raise their hand. Two, they have to opt in, and they consent to voluntarily share information. So unlike all the third parties and that we see in New York Times, or there was a movie called The Great Hack, where it showed that people's data were actually being collected and aggregated without their knowledge. We went just the opposite. We said we put the people first, and they have to actually opt in and consent to voluntarily share. What that enabled was an incredible trust and brand equity in the People Platform as both a source of value, but also the opportunity to really inform organizations directly to the CEO, CMO, and COO's desk. So that was really what we tried to do with the People Platform. And now we have 13 different industries that are on our 5-box strategy, which is essentially a standard way, because we knew in enterprise technology, customization and professional services was difficult. So we essentially said people, engaging devices, opting in to share, and then sharing their information and then driving value. That was kind of the 5-box that applied to all industries. So we had 13 different industries, 95 million people in the United States, and in locations were in airports, restaurants, movie theaters, hospitals, healthcare providers, physician offices. And it gives you a really interesting look where if my 4th grade teacher was here, I'd say, hey, we're moving toward connecting with everyone in the world. And certainly in the United States, we have the nearest to a census population that wants to share that feedback. So I think it's very powerful when you let people sound off and let people participate actively, both in the imagination process, but also in the innovation process of here's what our needs are, develop products and services that we need versus a SKU on the shelves of a large big box retailer, grocery store, or otherwise.
Yeah, that sounds like an interesting departure from what you think of social media as being. Like a lot of brands, you know, they made a Facebook page, they made a Twitter handle, then just started kind of putting some brochureware out of there. And Sometimes they got angry mobs coming back over something they did. Sometimes they got praised, but there was no way to really organize the feedback at all. And then with Facebook, I heard a good quote, if the service that you're using is free, then you are the product. So Facebook is basically just taking all of your information, aggregating it, selling it to folks. And you hear kind of creepy stories and scenarios that happen around that. But it sounds like you guys are getting folks to opt in and they're actually getting compensated for participating.
Correct. That was really the important part, was we wanted people to be at the center, thus the people platform. We wanted people to make the decision whether or not they even wanted to participate. And then we wanted to say, in very similar and basic terms, is your data is valuable. You are valuable. And your information and perspective is valuable. And I think some of that's been lost in the community and the culture today. Obviously, there's miscommunication happening. There's fear out there. There's a lot of misinformation. But what we said was, if we can ask people and we can listen and we truly enable that direct conversation between consumer and company, things will get better. And I always bet on people. And I think that's where we said, hey, if we can provide that voice and we can deliver that data in a fashion that is valuable on both sides, it makes it much better. But I think you're right. The model, I believe, is shifting, right? So I think it's going to become more about the people economy, and not just people as innovators, but people as consumers. For a long time, it was advertising that was driving. And if you look at it, people, I think, are finished being called impressions or called a click or you are the product. And I think there is a shifting mode, which we've seen incredibly high conversion rates with people. And the reason that is that they feel recognized. 93% of people in the United States today feel like brands don't respect them, don't recognize them, and don't value their opinion. That's a sad state when 99.6% of people want to share personal information. It shows that they're done with the mass market brand out, we know better than you, versus the really innovative brands are listening and trying harder and harder to make that connection, collaborate, and keep up with the consumer. I think social media has been an incredible tool set in the sense that the consumer's broadcasting live all the time. They have the ability to vote yay or nay on your brand on a moment's notice, and they have wide access to communities of people that care like them. I think the truly difficult part for brands was they were always in reaction mode. Now they can say, hey, rather than look at Yelp posts or otherwise where there's someone just ranting about us, let's organize it, to your point. Let's coordinate how we want to have the dialogue and make sure it's relevant. And I think what we're finding is people are being much more receptive to sharing their thoughts, sharing the ideas, and knowing that this is a free form dialogue that is going to a value point where it's valuable for both sides.
So what's the evolution from here? Where does Epicenter Experience go now?
You know, what's been interesting for me is we raised a little bit more capital recently, and we really said we want to be a municipality for people, right? So just like your energy grid or otherwise, we want to be the electricity that allows people to voice their opinion, highlight concerns, and try to drive innovation and positive impact. I think we've seen that successfully in healthcare, education, retail, financial services, automotive. There was always a much bigger vision going all the way back to fourth grade and Hope High School. I think there's no substitute really for the face-to-face interaction. So albeit I love and admire and respect the 95 million people that have come to the People platform and engaged one of our client locations, but I think there's still a need for a physical place, right? And I think that having the ability to truly have a place that is a retreat that feels very much like a sanctuary of people. And I always say it's like a museum gallery of people. Everyone's invited. There's no one who's better or worse than the other. There is no hierarchy. But people arrive either for inspiration with an idea. And I said it needs to be open source. And it needs to be open source because, yes, you might be an expert at podcasts. And this physician may be an expert at orthopedic surgery. However, the problems of the world today are multifaceted and complex. My goal was to say, acquire a property that essentially is very low tech on the outside, which shows everyone is equal. But inside, it's very high tech and high touch, where we can connect with this global community that I saw in Amsterdam and saw in Costa Rica and now have seen in business, to bring people together, not just people to solve the problems, but see how problems are solved through relationships, through connection, through collaboration. So I have this vision of a place in Plymouth, and you say, well, why Plymouth? And it's kind of going back to when the Pilgrims first landed here in Massachusetts, and maybe that's me being provincial, there was that first winter. And without collaboration, no one was going to survive. And I think if you look fast forward 400 years, it's the 400th year of Plymouth. And you say, we still struggle with some of those challenges, both socially, economically, culturally, educationally. And I think creating a truly physical place kind of brings us back in that Van Buren way to saying, hey, return to the land, return to face-to-face, be able to have a conversation openly, be open to multiple opinions to get through that first winter. But for me, I think it's really going to be the legacy project for myself, where it is bringing people together from my network, but then surrounding that with the youth, right? So the youth, actually similar to my Hope High School days, they want to see and they want to know that they can participate. They have a lot to offer. They may not know how they can contribute, but you can't count anybody out. They really need to understand, hey, I can participate. I could be the last puzzle piece that solves this problem. And we've seen that time and time again through technology, where you're sitting in a room, we have the smartest people around the table, and it turns out that it's someone who enters and interlopes into the meeting and says, by the way, that looks wrong on the whiteboard. It should actually look like this. And it turns out to be the unlocking case. As I said to you, Andrew, I always bet on people. So I think where the people platform and Epicenter really goes is this combined integrated view of technology in a enterprise software way with a physical location that creates a Aspen Institute or Milken Foundation sense of openness and awareness and acceptance of all people, all ideas, but really charts the blueprints. Like I always said, and you know this better than anyone, which is when we retire, all of our relationships kind of go away. And my goal with this project is really to say, hey, we give the next generation the leg up with a better relationship network, a better foundation, and better core set of values to truly understand and invest in people to get the best creative outcomes, whether that's through technology or from a social perspective.
Now, do you have a code name or anything for this new thing you're doing in Plymouth?
Yeah, you know, we've thought a lot about it, and we've started to narrow some things down to a derivative of ethos. And really, ethos is more about the spirit and the driving force of a culture. And I think there's an opportunity to kind of reimagine the ethos in this country. I think there's no question that we are the most innovative, the most advanced, the population has so much to give. But again, it's listening and it's hearing and it's allowing people to participate. And I think some of the great things that are going on now in this trying time with the pandemic and the political environment and the social issues that we're seeing is people are stepping up. People aren't waiting for governments or healthcare or others to create solutions that work. And I think that's what's so inspiring to me, where I said, even though I've been working on this vision that started in looking at the poor farm in Milton, Massachusetts, which was a 40-acre parcel, and that was 10 years ago. So while it's been 10 years in the making, there's no better time. So I think to reestablish, reaffirm, and kind of reimagine the ethos in there. But I'd certainly welcome any feedback from the audience on names for a place where everyone is welcome. You come with an open mind, you contribute actively to solving the problems, and you come with a ability to be able to communicate, to understand, and never have a hardwired position. I think that's where I would take that kind of technology metaphor and bring it here. You want to be Wi-Fi, right? You don't want to be hardwired and connected to the wall. You want to be able to say, hey, I'm open to change. I'm willing to change. And those are the people that truly are always welcome around me, but I also think will transform the culture and the society that we live in today.
So folks, if you do have any suggested names for Ethos or want to comment on the episode or are interested in becoming a guest on Underserved, the best way to get in touch is our email, which is underserved@syrinx.com. That's underserved@syrinx.com. And as we're kicking off season 3 here, you can also hear all of our older episodes of Underserved from seasons 1 and 2 at our website, underserved.fm. That's underserved.fm, like radio.
Yes, like radio.
So with COVID-19, I got to imagine that it's been differently affecting Ethos for an in-person plan, as well as the People platform for more of a distributed technology, no-touch plan. How has that affected both sides?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it really is allowing both people and organizations and companies to kind of rethink their models, right? So if I take one of the clients that has been really innovative is Best Buy, right? So here you have big box retailer where COVID shut down. Sure, they moved over to curbside, but what they actually did was say, how do we understand the people that visited the Best Buy? How do we connect with them? What are their behaviors? How are they purchasing? How are they considering and educating themselves? So in that one example, I think they really wanted more intelligence from the consumer and what is the behavior? How is it going to change? Are these numbers going to continue? On the flip side, I think there's going to be a bigger ability to look at small in-person meetings. I think those will continue. I think you're right. Some of the large conferences and otherwise tracked the Biogen conference through some of our location services. And it was unbelievable to see Long Wharf Marriott as a concentration of just device IDs where they were there. But then we watched over time on almost a time lapse where they went in Cambridge back to the headquarters, which devices they were interacting with that weren't from the conference. And then you could almost see the spread of COVID from that conference, which was interesting. So I think those kinds of large gatherings are going to change. We've seen it in everyday life. The Patriots game last night in Kansas City, I was shocked still to see approximately 16,000 people in the stadium. That was interesting. So I think some of those large gatherings, but the gatherings we're talking about inside of the Ethos farm retreat side, I think there'll be smaller roundtable discussions. I'm thrilled also that Chef Barbara Lynch here in Boston has said there's one amazing thing about food, and it's the ability to gather people around a table. So she and I are partnering on this effort to essentially not only bring great food, which she always brings, but thoughtfulness and showing that different perspectives and opinions matter. So I think it will still be in those small ways. I also think that COVID's given an opportunity for people to kind of rethink going to hotels and finding more of these destinations out there. But my goal will be connecting, making sure we can connect both physically and virtually. I think Zoom and Meet and Google have done a good job kind of connecting people. I think they had to rethink that model a bit too, with just how many people are on and bandwidth and otherwise. But my goal is to not have any of the actual in-person or virtual be exclusive. And I really want to open the doors virtually as well through the technology that I've learned to build, as well as kind of physically in that open door. But know that anybody's welcome in your audience, and certainly they'll get the royal treatment, and maybe we'll do a podcast from down there at some point.
I like it. We do have all the gear to go on location, but we only do it once in a while.
All right. Well, make it once in a while for us, would you?
All right. Sounds good. So we talked a bit about the power of relationships. Are there any concrete stories you have where that's really come to fruition in your own life?
Always. I think relationships are crucial, whether it's the investors who believe in you as a person and say, hey, we'll be with you for 10 years, regardless of how this project or this company goes. I think those are always the relationships. You never second guess or count any of your relationships out. And I would say to anybody, make sure that you leave relationships on good terms always.
Any good video content or books or other things that you've read recently?
Yeah, you know, there was really an interesting time in my life where I was going through a transition, you know, really thinking about who am I authentically and wanted to be kind of real and authentic and live the way I wanted to, connect with people, give back, have positive impact. And David Brooks wrote a really interesting book called The Second Mountain. And it sounds so simple and fundamental, but it was a great reminder of we all are in college and we're uncertain. and we don't know what we're going to be. We don't know what we're going to do. And yet there's this social pressure to come home with the summer internship or go to Wall Street and make your parents proud. But he talks about the first mountain, so that you get on this first mountain, which is your first job, and you start to run. And at that point, there's one thing that you left at this train stop, which is the bag of your authenticity. And if you haven't thought through and you haven't settled yourself on who am I, what do I want to do, who do I want to be, you're always running for somebody else. So I think the first mountain he talks about is you run really hard, you're accumulating things. It's about your identity and your influence, and it might be about the car or the house or things. And he said, you quickly reach the top of that mountain, or at least some number of us do, a high percentage of us do. And you kind of realize as you look over the precipice, this is it. This is it. And you can say, hey, you're in a 1% of all people, either earnings or success or milestones or deals, but that actually sweeps you off the first mountain. And you go through this period in the wilderness that David does a great job of describing, where you have to truly sit there with yourself and say, what is it that I want to be? And a lot of people, he says, like roadkill, live and never come out of that wilderness area. That's kind of the valley that he talks about. But then he says, of the people who stand up, recognize that they weren't perfect. They realize the first mountain was just that, the first mountain. There's a second mountain, which is, he talks about in the first mountain, happiness, right, is really about your personal achievements, and they're temporary. That happiness kind of is just, hey, I succeeded. I won this game. I did this deal. I did a negotiation. I built this technology. In the second mountain, he talks about joy, which is really about giving to other people. And if you live your life that way, it's an enduring thing that kind of takes you through. And I thought it was very pertinent to just how I wanted to live my life. I kept flipping through the pages and saying, yes, this makes sense. But yes, it's easy. But I think so much of our world today in society is about who are you based on how you're perceived, or what's the perception of you, or how do you identify? And it was interesting as I was going through this transformation, just personally, health-wise, and looking to the next thing and making sure the People platform was successful in getting the gumption to actually try to put an offer in on this property that will become Ethos. You sit there and you say, yeah, but I'm sure what I am doing now is right. There's a passion, there's a purpose. And it is giving to other people. And it's funny because a lot of the questions that I get are, well, what's the benefit for you? And I stumble on that one all the time as far as the answer. And I usually just say, nothing. I get the smile. I get the feeling. I get that joy, that kind of inner sense of advancement by looking at a young kid who you can get an internship and has now worked for you for 4 years. Connor Biddle is our now creative director at the company. He came up to me and said, hey, I don't know what this is all about, but I want to work with you. And I said, he's gone on to do really great things. My younger brother, John Krasinski, is a great story as well, just from coming to Brown, finding his own path, and then ultimately saying, hey, do you think mom and dad would be upset if I say I want to be an actor? And I said, no, do you love it? And that was the key question. And he said, yeah, I do. And his first pilot didn't get picked up. And he said, I don't know, Paul, here I am in New York making cocktails that I don't even know what a Greyhound is. What am I doing with my life? And he came and showed me the DVD of The Office. And I said, but do you love it? Because I'm not sure this one's going to go either. And so every Christmas or holiday season that he comes back, he's like, you sure it's still not mass market? So clearly I'm not listening to the consumers out there as much as I should in audience measurement. But it's a good story. I think really for your audience, it's kind of challenging yourself to say, hey, what is it that I really want to do? And I think the second that you think about it less as a job or a task that you have to do versus what is your purpose? And I think it's very hard to do because guess what? There's a lot of people that want to judge you for what it is that you love or say, well, why would you do that? Why would you build a place? Aren't your kids and family enough? And why do you need to contribute more to the culture? And I think all of us have that feeling that stand up like Jerry Maguire and say, okay, who's coming with you? And at that point, you just hope that more than the goldfish are coming with you. But as Seth Godin says in his The Tribes We Leave, you really only need a small group of people to spark something that's really special and drive a revolution and reimagine spaces, cultures, economies. So I know that there's a lot of people in the tech industry that listen to your podcast, and you're so good at what you do as far as creating content. But I think it's challenging in times like this to say, well, I just need to show up. I just need to do my job, and then I need to go home. And I would challenge, there's no better time than now where it's uncertain. Kind of walk through the valley in the wilderness and find your own second mountain. Because I promise you, all the people who listen to your podcast have ideas. They have innovative ideas. They have solutions to world problems. They may not believe that they do yet, but I'm telling you, they do. And I would say, get active and lead change for yourself.
All right, Paul. Well, thank you very much for coming down in person and sharing all of this with us today.
Thank you, Andrew. And thanks to the audience for listening. Hopefully, they will be inspired to go out and lead change in their communities and their companies as well.
Excellent. And we'll talk to all of you again on the next episode of Underserved.